this episode of the Fisheries Podcast, I talk with Jeff Conway from Inks Dam National Fish Hatchery about some of the work he is doing there, as well as other stops in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at FisheriesPod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. Our guest today is Jeff Conway. Jeff is the manager of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Inks Dam National Fish Hatchery in Central Texas, where he has worked since 2016. He grew up in a small town in northwestern Pennsylvania, where he attended Mansfield University and obtained a bachelor's degree in fisheries in 1994. He began his career in research of aquatic diets and propagation in Pennsylvania and gained expertise in fish culture at hatcheries in North Carolina, Colorado, Kentucky, and New Mexico. Jeff has worked with a variety of species, including many of the popular sport fish from throughout the U.S., as well as many non-game and imperiled species that many may not have heard of. When not squeezing fish, Jeff enjoys working on old Toyota Land Cruisers. Welcome to the podcast, Jeff.
Thank you, Nick. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Jeff, I guess, what is it about Land Cruisers that you like? That's kind of an odd one for, I guess I haven't heard too many people that enjoy Land Cruisers.
I bought my first one when I was living in North Carolina, and it's almost a cult. They're really dependable, rugged vehicles, and I was really drawn to them. Can't say that my wife is too enthused with them, but I definitely enjoy them, and it gives me something to tinker with when I'm not at work.
When you get one all fixed up, do you enjoy just going out cruising with them, or do you take them off-roading?
I do mostly off-roading. I don't do as much as I used to, but when I was in Colorado, we definitely took them off-road lately. I'm actually in between Land Cruisers right now, so I'm looking for the next good candidate.
Do you just fix them up and sell them, and then once you play with them a little bit, then you get a new one to fix up?
Yep. So, like I said, it's definitely a little bit of a cult. I've had several now and done different things with them, and I'm looking to do more of a restoration this next time instead of the modifications I did for off-roading.
Well, in your bio, I also mentioned that you've worked in a variety of hatchery systems in five different states and covering a pretty diverse set of landscapes. Do you have a favorite locale that you worked at, or considering the scenery and the fish?
So I can't ever say that I had a bad location. I definitely have some that I liked more than others, but they were all pretty amazing. Top of my list, it would be the Hotchkiss National Fish Hatchery out in Hotchkiss, Colorado. That's on the western slope. My house was right along the west fork of the Gunnison, north fork of the Gunnison. So a beautiful stream right outside my door. It was a really neat project there. But I enjoyed my time in Kentucky. The job in North Carolina was up in the mountains of North Carolina, so that was beautiful. In New Mexico, I was in northern New Mexico, so again, beautiful country. So that's the one good thing I can say about my career. The places I've been have all been spectacular. And the projects were even better. So I firmly believe that pretty much any project I've worked with has had significant value.
And the audience of this podcast is largely scientists, but there are some other listeners that may be curious. And just in case, we throw some terms out later in this interview, would you mind explaining kind of the general process for raising fish in the various hatchery systems you've worked on, from going from brood stock to stocking the young of those fish?
Sure. They run the gambit for me. So I've done endangered fish where there aren't very many members of the population, and you actually have to look at the genetics and actually do pair spawning. That was the Gila trout in New Mexico. The populations were so small that most of the fish were interrelated, so you'd have to actually work with the genetics lab to figure out which fish to spawn with which fish to keep your genetic diversity. But after that, it was just basically trout spawning. So we would actually collect milt from the males, express milt, and then we would check viability by adding water to the milt to make sure the sperm was alive and moving. And then we move on to the female, strip the eggs out, usually into a container, Ziploc bag, something like that. Then introduce the milt to the eggs, and then you know, mix the eggs together, activate with water, and then within 30 seconds, the eggs would have been fertilized. Now with catfish, what I do now, it's we don't play such a large role in catfish culture. We actually put out a container for the catfish to spawn in, and then after they've fertilized the eggs, we go out and actually steal them. So it's a little bit different approach. Then we bring those back into the hatchery and incubate them. With catfish, it's only usually 10 days at the hatchery's water temperature when we collect the eggs. Trout, of course, depends on whatever water temperature you're in. Sometimes it takes 30 days or more, particularly if you're chilling them. And then the other thing we do currently is freshwater mussels. So that was definitely something that wasn't covered when I went to school, freshwater mussels. But most of those need an intermediate host. So we actually go out and look for gravid female mussels in the wild and bring those back to the hatchery and then express the glaucidia out of the mussel. And then we find whatever host fish that has been identified to be a host fish for that particular mussel. And then we infest, basically put the fish in with the glaucidia. And the glaucidia will actually attach to the fish's gills or sometimes the skin. Gills are definitely the preferred attachment site. So if some people are unfamiliar with a glaucidia, or they're just the young stage of a freshwater mussel, and they look like little Pac-Man. A lot of them have some kind of hook or attachment where when they come in contact with the gill arch or skin, they'll actually clamp down and latch in, and then that will actually insist into the gill arch or the skin, and then they actually transform on the fish and then drop off later. So we're actually working with some of these rare Central Texas mussels that not a lot is known about. It runs the gambit for species. Everyone's a little bit unique. So those are just a few that I threw out right off the bat. But from then on, you collect the young, you got to take care of the young, wait till they swim up and introduce feed. So a lot of the feeds we feed have been, they're a commercial diet that has been time tested. When I started my career, I worked for Pennsylvania, and we were actually looking at diet development for pond-reared walleyes. We were looking to convert pond-reared walleyes to a dry diet. It's basically, at least at that time in 91, it was a bad idea. I'm sure times have changed, but I've kind of been away from that. And then it's just taking care of the organisms to their size, either stock or reproduce, and keep your brood stock. Brood stock management, of course, is very important. I could go on this, so I don't know how much in-depth you want me to get.
Oh, I think that was a good little crash course on it all. So you originally sent me a long list of species that you've worked on that included brook, brown, rainbow, and Gila trout, coho salmon, walleye, muskie, tiger muskies, American shad, paddlefish, and channel catfish, and you mentioned some of those in your last answer. There's one that really caught my attention, mainly because I hadn't heard of it before, and that was the Amur pike. Could you tell us a little bit about this fish and what you were doing with them at the time?
Sure. So the Amur pike was actually a fish from Russia. And when I was working for the Pennsylvania Fish Commission, it was before they became the Fish and Boat Commission. So this was in the 90s. It was a fish that, for my information, again, I was young in my career, so I might not have had the full story. But during the centennial, Russia and the United States traded fish, or at least the Pennsylvania Fish Commission traded fish with Russia. We got the Amur pike, and I think they got muskies or something along those lines. Again, I don't know the full story, just what I was told. So they're a Russian fish that Pennsylvania was rearing, at least in the 90s, early 90s. But it's mostly like a pike or a muskie. So same family, but they were pretty unique. As far as I know, Pennsylvania was the only one that's ever reared them intensively here in the U.S.
Did any of those get stocked out in Pennsylvania waters?
Yeah, they did. So I think there's still a state record for an Amur pike. I don't know what it is, but I think that program kind of faded out. But there for a while, and as far as I know, there's still a record for Amur pike in Pennsylvania.
Any chance any of those are still swimming around in the waters of Pennsylvania?
I would think so, but since pike are fairly long-lived, I would think that there's some maybe. I'd like to think that there's some still out there. But I don't really know.
Now, that'd be quite the catch if someone was still able to find one.
Sure.
We just read through the long list of different species you've worked on in your hatchery career. And you've covered both warm water and cold water fish culture. I guess, what are the differences between those two temperature systems? And is one of them easier to raise fish in than the other?
Well, most of my career I've been with cold water fish, so trout and salmon. So just since I've done it for so long, I kind of lean towards trout and salmon. I think they're easier to manage because most of the times you got them in raceways and you control most of the variables with trout. With catfish, it's a whole different ballgame. You're raising fish in ponds, so you have a whole host of issues with the temperature, the weather, with predation. That's the big one for me is predation. It's not something I'm usually used to. Most of the hatcheries I've worked at had some kind of bird protection for trout, so that wasn't really an issue. But when you're talking, 30 acres of ponds, it's not really cost effective to enclose or put nets over your ponds. So trying to manage around predation on your fish to figure out how many you need for the end game, that's pretty tough, at least for me. But again, I like to say I'm a trout guy. I've been a trout guy a long time. So I definitely lean that way. It may not be the case, but that's how I see things.
All right, and you do get to control some of those birds that are preying on your fish, don't you? Can you go out there with the cackle flares?
So we have a couple different control methods. So we have a pyrotechnics that we're allowed to use, and we have propane cannon. The thing we started using was actually called a sky puppet, but basically it's the thing you see at the used car lots, the thing that looks like a man that dances around in hot air, and they seem to work pretty well. And of course, the last resort is we have a permit with the U.S. from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to discourage a few.
Of all the fish that you've worked on, which of those stands out as the most meaningful conservation work that you've worked or been involved with?
I think they've all have their places. I mean, I've enjoyed every one of them, but probably the one that holds my heart the most is the Gila trout. I went to Mora in 2007, and the program there wasn't in good shape. We weren't producing very many fish. Egg quality was really bad. Broodstock was bad, and I can't take credit for it all, so I'm not even going to try, but there was a bunch of people involved there. We had geneticists. We had some good project leaders. We put together a program to revive the Gila trout. And the first year I was there, I think we stocked out 1,000 or 2,000 fish. So when you realize that a whole facility is dedicated a year to producing a couple thousand fish, that's not a good place to be. And when I left, we were producing over 100,000 fish, genetically appropriate fish. So that's where all the genetic work with our geneticists comes in, doing pair spawning, looking at the coefficient relationship to make sure we have appropriate fish to go back out in the wild. And according to some of the research that some of the partners were doing on that project, our fish were genetically the same as the fish in the wild. So that was pretty exciting. That definitely holds my heart. I know the current project leader there, Nate Weesey, he's actually moved the project even further ahead. But I was there when it was bad, and we weren't producing very many. And I'm just proud of the fact that we brought that fish back, and I think it's in a better spot now than it was when I arrived.
All right, and you mentioned it in one of your first answers. It's not just fish you're raising in your hatcheries. You mentioned some mussel work. And Ink's Dam just kind of started this entering the realm of mussel culture. I guess, what got you or the powers that be interested in raising mussels? And I guess, can you recap some of those differences between fish and mussel culture?
So I actually raised mussels when I was in Kentucky. We were working with Tennessee Tech, Region 4 was, at least the Wolf Creek National Fish Hatchery was, and it didn't go well. We were trying to raise artificial food in the hatchery to feed the fish because the hatchery there took water off the bottom of the dam. It was cold, not a whole lot of nutrients. It just wasn't appropriate for mussels. So when I took this job, I said, man, I really want another chance at this because I don't want to sound conceited, but it's pretty much the only thing I ever failed at was raising mussels. So I knew when I interviewed for the position here that definitely they were considering mussels to be something to brought on the Ink's Dam. And the reason for that is they're the first things to go when a river starts to go bad. I mean, they're very sensitive. if you don't know, they're the most endangered group of animals there are. It's interesting because of their intermediate host life cycle. You have to find the host fish, and then you have to infect that fish. And some of the mussels only produce glaucidia for a very short amount of time. So they're called short-term brooders. There's other ones that will hold them for months. But some of those short-term brooders are weak, less. And you have to find that mussel at the right time to get those glaucidia out to infest the fish. So not only do we have to have the right conditions in the hatchery, we actually have to have almost a field branch at the hatchery going out and looking for these things consistently. And since they're found in deep water sometimes, you know, with the Fish and Wildlife Service, we have to have people that are able to snorkel or to scuba dive. So that was something we had to develop to actually go out and look for these organisms. So it's a cool project. And Texas actually approached the Fish and Wildlife Service as a trial basis to see if we could help them out identifying the mussels that we're rearing, three central Texas mussels, the Texas fat mucket and the Texas pimpleback and the smooth pimpleback are the three species that we're working with. The good thing is all three of them have fairly common host fish, at least from our perspective, green sunfish and bluegill and channel catfish. So that's definitely something we can get a hold of. Now, some of the species in Kentucky that we were working with or trying to work with, it's a rare mussel that goes with a rare fish. So finding those two things was pretty difficult. Here in Texas, we're a little bit more fortunate that we actually have a common fish species with the mussels. And as I said, the intermediate host, keeping those alive definitely provides another challenge. And you have to be careful you don't over-infest the fish. So if you leave the fish in there too long, you get too much attachment. Glaucidia will attach too much and actually kill the fish. So it's a narrow band. It's a little bit of a learning curve. I'm fortunate that I have a very dedicated staff that was willing to try this because we weren't mussel people when we started. I've been grateful for that too.
Mentioned earlier in the interview, they'd go out and you'd check to see whether these mussels were gravid. I guess, how do you tell if a mussel is gravid?
So they'll actually display a little bit, and they're pretty cool. A lot of the mussels they'll have, and again, I'm not a mussel expert, so any mistakes are mine and mine alone. But they'll have displays, and what they're looking to do is they're looking to bring fish in. And when the fish bites down on them, because they'll see what they think is a fish. If you have a chance, Google some mussel videos. They're pretty cool. They'll have eye spots and they'll wiggle like a fish. So when the fish comes in, they'll bite down on that lure and they'll get a big mouthful of glaucidia, which will then attach to the fish. So that's basically what my staff is looking for when they go out. They're looking for these displays of gravid females. And then when you find them, you can actually check in them and see the packets in there where the glaucidia are.
And is this program still kind of on a trial basis, or have you released some of these hatchery-reared mussels back into the rivers and streams of Texas?
Oh, no. We're a long way from that, in my opinion. There's a lot of work that still needs to be done. We need to make sure that what the mussels that we're rearing are genetically appropriate to where we're putting them. You know, if we produce a mussel that doesn't, it's not going to live in the place we stock it. I mean, we got to have pieces of the puzzle in place, which we don't have yet. It's a relatively, at least here in Texas, I know back east, they've been doing it a long time. It's kind of a new game. So there's a lot of pieces that have to be put in place before we release anything. So any mussels we produce, and we've produced a few, we keep those in-house, and we continue to try to refine our techniques with them. So these are not listed, at least as of yet. So they're, you know, mussel species we can still work with.
Inks Dam is also one of the first facilities in the country to launch a first catch center in partnership with the Recreational Boating and Fishing Foundation. What is a first catch center?
As you suggested, it was a relationship with the Sport Fish Boating Council, where they fund a secondary agency, which is called Fishing Futures. And we developed these centers to introduce families to fishing. So a lot of the past efforts have been targeted solely at kids. And this is an effort that actually targets families. So it's just not the kids we're looking for. We're looking for the parents too. And the whole premise of this model is we want to expose people three times to fishing events. There's a lot of research and evidence that says once you get exposed to something three times, you're more likely to continue with it. So we were one of several sites. So there's some sites back, I believe, in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, and there's a wildlife refuge here in Texas that was also selected as sites to start this program. The turnout's been amazing. People have a really good time. They come to the hatchery. You don't hear very often, you come to the hatchery and go fishing a little bit. So I have a pond set aside where after they go through the training of the course, they can actually go out and catch some catfish. They're pretty big catfish too. So it's pretty cool seeing little kids pulling catfish as big as they are. It's a really neat program. And we've done three events now, and that's what they want us to try. But I have a friends group here at the hatchery that's very excited about this kind of event. So we're going to move forward with doing more of these.
That sounds like a great program. We have Fishing's Future here in Kansas, but we don't have any of these first catch centers that I'm aware of. So that's probably something we'll get into down the road.
Like I said, it's a really neat program. And
all right, Jeff, thank you for filling us all in on the inner workings of your hatchery at Inks Dam. But now the tough part of the interview is over, as we are down to the final five questions. And this is a group of five questions that I ask each of the guests that come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
My favorite fish is probably a walleye. I grew up off Lake Erie, fishing for walleyes in Lake Erie and in Canada. So that's my favorite.
All right. And what is your favorite memory from your career so far?
I guess my favorite memory is watching Gila trout go back to Arizona for the first time. So we actually took Gila trout back to Arizona. We flew them in for the first time. That was pretty cool.
And what is your dream job or dream location to work in?
My dream location, I would probably like to go back to Colorado. It's a really neat place. I really enjoyed it there. So Colorado, I would be remiss in saying maybe a place in Pennsylvania just to get a little closer to family. But I really enjoy Inks Dam. So here in Texas, definitely it's a little bit different than I'm used to. I was up north in the northern New Mexico, hardly ever gets over 80 degrees where I was. And I come down here and it gets 110. So that's a little bit of a change.
And if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
Money was no object. I guess working again with the Gila trout, I really like that project. It's pretty cool to see what we did with those fish.
And then finally, if there is one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
Don't be afraid to take a risk. I mean, in your career, you're probably going to fail, but don't be afraid of failure, because I've learned the most from things I did wrong. And that would be my advice. Don't be afraid to try things.
All right, Jeff, thank you again for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and all your projects down there in Texas. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
So you can contact me by email, jeff_conway@fws.gov, or you can call me at the hatchery number, 512-793-2474.
And if you'd like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download and subscribe to receive future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 35th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, don't be afraid to take a risk.